Turn in your Bibles to Matthew chapter 22. Jason pointed out to me last week a fundamental flaw in my lesson. And he did it very lovingly and very graciously. And it's because he really did want to know, and I always encourage questions. But basically, I don't know if you guys remember, but we've been talking about Jesus and the Pharisees going like this. And the big question last week was about the levirate marriage. And hey, what if somebody gets remarried seven times in heaven? Who's their spouse going to be? That question. And I went round and round about the afterlife and why we believe in resurrection physically and things like that. I never addressed the question, which is, so what about the woman in heaven with seven husbands? I will do that today. So my bad. I got a little distracted, a little sideways with that. So we are in Matthew 23 today, but we're going to back up just a hair and get into Matthew chapter 22. As always, before we begin, though, I would love for us to pray and ask for God's guidance. And that is for all of us, and that is why we're going to pray corporately. So if you guys would please join me in praying the Our Father, as Jesus taught His disciples to pray back in His Sermon on the Mount. So if you guys would join with me in prayer. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be Thy name. Thy kingdom come, Thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For Thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. All right, well, just a quick reminder of where we are. Remember, we are now in Jerusalem, okay? All of Matthew up to this point has been up in Galilee and Capernaum and a little bit further north. When we're on the map, we're talking about most of everything we talked about in the first part of Matthew happens up here. It's rural, small villages, things like that. And it's also edged by what would be considered Gentile lands, very heavy Roman influences, Gentile pagan influences, those kinds of things. So those things were addressed in a lot of things that Jesus did, including whenever Peter recognizes Jesus as Messiah. That literally happens at the one of the temples to Pan and Pan worship. So they leave from here, but he's come down to Jerusalem at this point. Jerusalem is up on a really in kind of a more of a mountainous region. So we've gone down from this valley, which is very hot, very arid, very desert, up to Jerusalem, and oftentimes they'll talk about going up to Jerusalem, and then they went into the city proper. And so this is where Jesus goes from dealing with the local rabbis, the local, what we'd say around here, the local pastors from the little churches, that kind of thing, to the center of the Jewish theological cosmos, and that is Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the capital. That is where the most learned, the most authoritative, the people that were in charge of the Jewish, not only legal system, but the royal system under Herod, and also the Roman administrative state. Because remember, make no mistake, this is all still part of the Roman Empire, right? So the Romans were in charge, but then you had this Jewish authority underneath that, which was under Herod, and you also had this religious authority, which was basically the Sanhedrin, oftentimes referred to as the scribes. And then you have these other words that are thrown around, like the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and we talked about that a little bit last week. These are some of those paintings I keep sharing with you guys from James Tissot, which I love. James Tissot's this painter who went to the Holy Land back in the 1800s and did tons of paintings. And the reason I like it is because everything that I see in those paintings is stuff that I saw when I was there. He gets the geography right, which is really cool. And I just really like some of his stuff. Reminder of what has happened up to this point. When Jesus arrives in Jerusalem, remember the first thing he does is he goes to the temple. He cleanses the temple. He curses the fig tree for the disciples to see, where he sees this tree and it has no fruit on it. And he's basically making an object lesson to his disciples about, look, trees are here to make fruit. If they don't make fruit, they're not doing what they're supposed to do, which is kind of the point he was trying to make. And this whole thing that we're going to not finish today, because it goes on for a couple of chapters, is Jesus interacting with different groups of people at the temple. First, he gets into this spat with the chief priest about Whose authority do you do this stuff by? What authority do you have to come into the temple and kick people out? Who said you get to do that? And then he shares those parables with them about where his authority really does come from. And by the way, when they asked him that, it was an honest question too, because a lot of people knew, and this was referenced a lot of times, he was one who taught with authority. People just recognized, this guy doesn't cite other rabbis. You know, most rabbis of that day would say, well, according to Rabbi Gamaliel, this, and they would, you know, have that teaching, or according to this person, or according to that person. Jesus never did that. He only quoted directly from Old Testament scriptures. And that was just something that just kind of, people understood that this guy is different. He's not like other folks. We had the question of coinage, render under Caesar, what is Caesar's, or render under God, what is God, which was basically directed at the Herodians, those who kind of wanted to work under Herod and you know, wanted to kind of catch him and maybe catch him in some sort of treasonous language about who he's supposed to be listening to and whether or not he should do what the Romans wanted him to do. Then last week we closed out with the Sadducees talking about the issue of life after death. And remember I said the Sadducees did not believe in life after death. That's why they asked him the question they asked him. Well, today, once we go back and address that issue, like I said we would, they're going to ask, what is the greatest commandment? And this is a Pharisaical question again. What is the greatest commandment? Then there's going to be a discussion of Messiah. And at that point, Jesus turns on a dime and he drops a hammer for like two chapters. And it's sometimes referred to as the woes. And there's multiple woes. We'll talk about woe and what that means. But basically, he just takes the Pharisees and rakes them over the coals for two whole chapters. And it's kind of awesome and kind of terrifying. And so we'll talk about that. Reminder of kind of what the area looked like. Remember, he was camping out over here in Bethany. He would always come through Bethphage, over the Mount of Olives, down through the Kidron Valley and into the temple area. And here's something I wanted to go ahead and pull up for you guys, if it will actually pull up today, because it didn't last week. I have found a really cool tool, if it will open today. Yay, it's going to open. And it's called Virtual New Testament. And any of you guys that are interested at all in kind of what's going on, for me, it always helps in order to picture things. Like, I'm a picture guy. I want to know where things are. And obviously, if you can go to the Holy Land, that's great. But if you can't, and by the way, even being in the Holy Land, it doesn't look the way today as it did back then. A lot of it does. But these guys have been destroying things, burning them to the ground, and building on top of it. Destroying things, burning to the ground, and building on top of it for centuries. Okay, so I showed you guys pictures last week of where I was, up on the Mount of Olives, which is still there, the Kidron Valley, and then that big massive wall on the other side. Well, that big massive wall that you're looking at is this. This thing is called Virtual New Testament. You can get it on iPad, you can get it on iPhone, you can get it on desktop. So you can download it anywhere. I'll go ahead and tell you, the Mormons put this out. This is put out by the Church of Latter-day Saints, LDS. They use it at BYU. I'll go ahead and tell you, their theology really messed up. However, in terms of their teaching tools, they've got really good stuff. And this is one of the best I've seen in terms of, it's basically has created a video game environment for Jerusalem in the first century to help you understand where things were and where stuff was located and what it looked like. So this is super cool. You can go to the city of Jerusalem and you can see, like what I was talking about, here's the Mount of Olives over here. And you can click on an area, and it will let you look at that area and let you see what it looked like. So if I'm looking here at the Kidron Valley, this is where those pictures were that I was showing you. This is from the Mount of Olives. And this is one of those main gates by which, you would have entrance. By the way, this is the gate that's been covered up, because the Muslims, basically, that's where Messiah is supposed to return to the Temple Mount at some point. And they covered it up, and they buried people in front of it, because that, therefore, made that ground sacred, and supposedly nobody could come through there again, as if that would stop God. So, anyway, it's just kind of an interesting thought. But from there, you can then look at, so here is the temple. This is the Antonian Fortress. This right here was actually built to honor Mark Antony. Remember Antony, Cleopatra, all that fun stuff? Well, at one point, Herod was very much trying to get in cahoots with all the Romans because, you know, he wanted to be in charge, and one of the things he wanted to do was make things in honor of the Roman prelates, that kind of thing. And this was a massive fortress on the back corner of this Temple Mount. It's going to be super important later when we start talking about Jesus' trial, because a lot of what happens to Jesus happens over there, okay? But as far as where Jesus is, tell you what, I'm going to go ahead and we're going to jump up here to the top of the Antonian Fortress. So this is the top of the fortress, as if I were looking down inside this courtyard. And this area right here, that's the temple. Notice there is this open courtyard around the temple. Then you've got all of this kind of shaded kind of portico areas here. And what we're going to do is we're going to jump around. We'll look at it from the other direction. So now we're looking at it from the other side. There's the Antonian Fortress. Here's the temple itself. This area here is called Solomon's Porch. This is where most people came into the temple. They would come up these massive steps. There's very, very large open entranceway for people to come up in that way. And they could come into this exterior courtyard right here, okay? So when we talk about the money changers and all of that happening, that happened out here, okay? That the overturning of the temples, of the money changers and all that kind of stuff, that stuff happened in this area and the farthest away from the temple courtyard area. We will get into this a little bit later, but this is an inner courtyard. This is the most inner courtyard, and of course the temple itself and the Holy of Holies inside there. So I'm going to show you what this would have looked like if we go to the Temple Mount itself, because one of the cool things about this is it will actually allow you to go inside. So this is if you were going into that inner courtyard area itself, and you can see what it would have looked like. But I want us to go over here because I want you guys to know where Jesus was teaching. So we're going to go outside of this area into this outer courtyard. And this in front of us is Solomon's Porch. And this is the court of the Gentiles. And as you go out here, underneath these big open areas over here, is where Jesus would have been teaching, okay? In these shaded areas. So all of this interaction we've been talking about would have happened in these areas, okay? And once again, to kind of give you some perspective, so there's the temple over there, okay? Anyway, I just wanted to show you guys that because I think it's super cool, and maybe I'm geeking out a bit, but anyway. I will actually come back to that, though. I'm going to show you guys that again when we start talking about some of the other things that happened with regard to Jesus' trial, because all of it happens right there around the Temple Mount area, and so we'll be looking at that. All right, so last week, remember the Sadducees came to Jesus and said, hey, what if there was this woman and she was married and her husband died and she got married again and that husband died and she got married again and that husband died and that, and so on and so forth. When she gets to heaven, who's her husband? And remember, this was the Sadducees' way of saying that whole life after death thing, there's a lot of absurdities in it. What are you going to do with that? Because remember, the Sadducees did not believe in life after death. The Pharisees did. Jesus obviously taught that, but it was a sect of Judaism that did not teach that because they didn't believe that afterlife was explicitly explained in the Old Testament, so that's why they had a problem with it. So Jesus' response was this. Jesus says, you are in error because you do not know the Scriptures or the power of God. At the resurrection, people will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like the angels in heaven. But about the resurrection of the dead, which is basically him saying, what you're asking about is the resurrection of the dead. Just so you know, Scripture does teach that there is a resurrection of the dead because he makes this point, I'm the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living, because there was always this reference to God being the God of those who had gone on before. And just because they had gone on before didn't mean he wasn't still their God. This idea that there's a presence to all of this, okay? So that's his first point. Back to the, but what about I mean, we talked about, was this a legitimate question or not? And I think it is. I think it's a legitimate question. It's a good question. So, what do you do with that? In actually answering the question, what do you think their problem was with the idea of someone having multiple husbands once they get to heaven? What's the point? What's their problem? What's their issue? What do you guys think?
I think they think that relationships that we have here on earth will be mirrored in heaven at some level. And so they're wanting to know how we're going to pair up or continue these relationships.
Right.
Including marriage.
Okay. Absolutely.
And it wasn't so much that they believed it, it's that that's what they heard other people saying. Well, your husband went on, you'll get to be with him later, you know? Or your child went, you'll get to be with them later. And they're hearing this, and they don't believe in the afterlife at all. Okay? So that they're just taking what they've heard, these things, like you said, the absurdities, to them, and they formulated a question with it.
Absolutely. Let me ask you guys this. Function of marriage at that time for Jews. Why? What was the purpose? To procreate, right? Especially if you were a female, the greatest blessing was children, right? And it was this idea that your lineage goes on, you continue to have children, that for a Jewish family, lots of children was a evidence of blessing, right? So, primary thing number one, procreation. What else? For females in particular, what was the function of marriage? What did it do? Like leveret marriage, what was the purpose?
Stability.
Stability? What else? Like with that stability, what do you mean stability in that way?
You have a place to live, you have food, you have someone taking care of you, you're protected.
Okay. Security, community, all of those things that you need, okay? So I want you to think of it in these terms. Jesus' response to them, this whole, looks like the front row for you guys. Good morning, y'all. So thinking of it in these terms, number one, procreation and lineage is not an issue in heaven. If you're talking about eternal life, okay, You don't continue to have children in order to, you know, continue the lineage. That's not an issue, okay? And that's one of the reasons, among many, that Jesus says what he says. Second, ownership is not an issue. And remember, this is a time where patriarchy was very much the dominant way of thinking, whether it was for the Romans, the Greeks, less so for the Jews, but still very much this idea that that there was this ownership concept, especially for the wives to husbands, or excuse me, husbands to wives. But even today, think of it in those terms. Do you feel like, yeah, you belong to your husband, you belong to your wife, there's this belonging idea. Okay, caretaking is not an issue. In heaven, there's no need for the stability, the security, the community, all those kinds of things that are very much earthly things we need, not an issue in heaven, not an issue in the resurrection, because you are going to have all of those needs met by God, because you are with God, you're in the presence of God. When we have those, not to do a heaven discussion again today, but this idea that in heaven, all of those needs are fulfilled in being in the presence of God. So community is not an issue, because you will know perfect community, right? So there's all of these things that get perfected, but the one that's maybe even more important, I think, is this idea of, so what does it mean to have everything redeemed in heaven? I mean, you know, when we talk about heaven is not you just get resurrected and you get to live forever, just kind of like you are now. When you are resurrected, that means that your old life is buried and everything is redeemed. it's made what it's intended. It's made what it's supposed to be. That's why we talked about this whole idea of physical resurrection. When I get resurrected, I'm not going to need glasses, right? So there's this physical healing that takes place. But it's not just physical, it's also spiritual. Think about how weak our love is here. Think about how we love one another. As much as you love one another, as spouses, as much as you love one another, as much as you love your children, is your love still perfect? It's flawed. It's broken. It's not quite perfect. So ask yourself, so what would a really perfect love look like between you and your spouse? There would be no ideas of jealousy. There would be no ideas of covetousness. There would be none of that. The highest love gives itself to the object of that love in service, right? It surrenders itself. So what would that really look like? So when you look at it from that perspective, the idea of seven spouses looks a little different. And that's why Jesus responds the way he does. So if you're wondering, what does perfect love look like? Well, 1 Corinthians 13, 4 through 7. Somebody want to look that up real quick? Would somebody like to read that for us? Go for it.
Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things.
That's the way you'll love. You know? Right. And I mean, it's, by the way, we say that at weddings and we aspire to that and we hope to do that, but we all know we all fail at that. We're miserable at it. Sometimes we're good at it, sometimes we're not. But that's that idea that Jesus was trying to get them to wrap their brains around, is you don't get it. It's not like here. Now, notice he says like the angels. He doesn't say you turn into an angel, okay? It's this idea that there is this spiritual component. I was actually talking to Chris about this last week, our pastor, and he's actually working on an article on this. And he was talking about, from a counselor's perspective, the idea of intimacy. And that in spousal relationships, the highest level of intimacy comes eventually through that physicality. That's the consummation of marriage, is supposed to bring greater and greater intimacy between two people. And what does that look like in heaven when you don't necessarily need that physical component? But it's a physical resurrection, so what does that look like? I don't know. I mean, we can only conjecture. We really, really don't know. But our intimacy will not be confined to our physicality. Does that make sense? There's no limit to that intimacy in heaven. So what does that look like? Now, I'm getting kind of theological, philosophical this morning, but I want you guys to at least broaden your idea of thinking about what heaven is, because heaven is not just us sitting on a cloud, strumming on a harp, living like we are today, because that would be incredibly boring. Our imaginations will be redeemed, our creativity will be redeemed, our love will be redeemed, everything, our imaginations will be redeemed, everything about us will be made new, will be made whole, and will be greater than anything we've experienced here, right? So your best day ever, lots better, right? Lots better. Okay, so let's keep going. So that's where we stopped last week. And here's where we go next. So Jesus immediately has these conversations, and he is talking with scribes, Pharisees, Sadducees. These are the smartest guys out there coming in here because they've heard Jesus is at temple. They probably approached, saw the crowds, and people were, coming up wanting to ask questions. And so he gets this one. Hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, because at that point the Sadducees didn't want to talk to him anymore, Pharisees got together, and one of them, an expert in the law, tested him with this question. Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law? And Jesus replied, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the first and the greatest commandment. The second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. So, where does this come from? Why would they ask a question like this? Be my first question to you guys. Why ask that kind of question?
Knowledge check, have you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Think about living as a Jew under the law. What's another question or a reason they might ask that particular question?
There are so many laws that you have to follow. It's like, well, which one is the most important? So if I follow the most important, my chances are better.
You got it. Would you feel comfortable knowing that you had to keep 613 laws, some of them traditional, some of them purity laws, some of them, would you be cool with that? Would you be confident of that? And here's the thing, he was talking to the rabbis. He was talking to the Pharisees, the guys that made a living out of following these laws. Do you think most people had the time, the inclination, the ability to even follow some of these traditional laws? They tried really hard, but this distillation of the law, and by the way, you could argue that those 613 laws, Moses distilled them down, or God distilled them down for Moses into 10, right? Jesus distilled them down even further. Like if you really have to ask me, here's where we go. And by the way, what is he quoting from? What is this that he is quoting? You guys know? What's that?
Deuteronomy.
It is Deuteronomy. What do we call this statement? Do you guys remember that? It's one of those Chris has taught before. You folks that went to Israel should remember what this, what is this? It's the Shema, right? The Shema. If you go to Deuteronomy and you look at 6:5, that's what you'll get. Everybody flip over to Deuteronomy. We did a study of Deuteronomy last year, so you guys should remember this. If you ever heard the old Rich Mullins song quoting Deuteronomy to the devil, remember that's Jesus quoted from Deuteronomy more than any other text. Okay, whenever he was and every time he was tempted in the desert, he quoted Deuteronomy. So Deuteronomy is the go-to here. So if you look at Deuteronomy chapter 6, we'll start in verse 4. He says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." Hear in Hebrew is Shema. And that's why they call the Shema, because it starts with hear, okay? "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." Verse 5, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. These commandments I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down, when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. And when the Lord your God brings you into the land he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you, a land with large flourishing cities you did not build, houses filled with all kinds of good things you did not provide, wells you did not dig, vineyards and olive groves you did not plant. Then when you eat and are satisfied, be careful you do not forget the Lord who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery." So that statement becomes one of the most important statements in Judaism to this day. If you go to synagogue, one of the things that they will do at some point during the worship time is they will recite the Shema. They will probably do it in Hebrew. I never was able to memorize it in Hebrew. We tried to do it when we went to Israel, and Hebrew's hard. I'll just go ahead and tell you. Anyway, so that is the Shema. So what Jesus has done is distilled everything down to those two things. And if you look at Leviticus 19:18, that is where... So if you'll flip over there, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Leviticus, take a left-hand turn, go back a little bit. So Leviticus 19:18, it says, "Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against one of your people, but love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord." So once again, Jesus did not come up with love your neighbor as yourself, okay? He was quoting, once again, Deuteronomy. So every time they accused Jesus of being a revolutionary or a rebel or that kind of thing, he always was just quoting the Old Testament. He would put a new spin on it, but he was always quoting the Old Testament, and that's what he does here. So so here's my question to you guys today. And by the way, we could talk a lot about this, but if you look at that first statement where he says, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, with all your mind." Those are not distinctives. What that's supposed to mean is in totality, with your whole person. The idea is you can't love God on Sunday, but not the rest of the week. You can't love God in your church, but not in your business. You can't love God in one relationship, but not in others. that the idea is that you are meant to be a whole person, and a whole person loves God with your entirety. When you don't, you are living a fractured existence. And that's what he's saying, is you can't live like that. That's not what you're supposed to do. So every time you say that, it's a reminder, no, I have to love God, not just while we're here, in this classroom, at church on Sunday. I'm supposed to live like this Monday morning when I face that guy in the office that drives me up a wall. Or when I'm teaching that kid I want to throw out a window. Or, you know, whatever it is. I have to love God in all of those circumstances. I cannot just, and this is another big one I think that sometimes people wrestle with. I cannot love God just in one area of my intellect but not another. I can't, and a lot of people struggle or will reject the church because they'll say, well, the church is anti-science, and therefore I can't embrace these things, which is so far from the history of the church and its relationship with science. But this idea that that it's assumed you're supposed to check your brain at the door and just believe, which is not at all what historic Christianity teaches, that you are absolutely supposed to embrace all areas of the intellect, okay? And that includes the sciences, what we call the natural world, and trying to see God in the natural world. So that's that idea. It's supposed to be in the whole you follow God. But here's my question to you, because I think it's super important. What if he had stopped there? If he had just said, there you go, that's it. But he doesn't. He follows it up with love your neighbor as yourself. And there's been some questions about who your neighbor is, but he pretty much in other teachings pretty much said, yeah, that's everybody. Okay. So what are the consequences of just one or the other? You guys tell me. What do you think? What do you think the consequences of just one or the other are? I just love God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength, or I love my neighbor as myself, but not both. What do you guys think? Sure you can. What does it look like, though? Bad. Why?
Incomplete.
Why is it incomplete?
Well, because the first law of love your Lord your God is a vertical relationship, and then when you establish that relationship, then the second one is, now take the power of that relationship, and then it becomes a horizontal relationship, so that you are a channel for that love. So that's the completeness.
Okay.
So if you have that love with God only, then how do you go across?
Mm-hmm.
Or if you only have that across, how do you reflect that with God? So if that person that you only love, your neighbor, and they hurt you, that's a separate relationship. If you didn't have that
But if you love God, take the neighbor out of the equation. If you love God, then the neighbor comes back into the equation. Because you cannot love God without following his commandments, correct? So I would agree that you can't at least love God without loving
him. You might do it as a monk would isolate themselves and say that you love God, but then you're not impacting the world. If you're impacting the world without the relationship with God, then that focus becomes you, as opposed to directing their focus to God. You become the focus. If I'm just saying I'm loving people and I don't believe in God, but then it's sort of, you know, it's about me at that point.
Okay, so to use the example of a monk, I'm sorry,
so
what were you going to say?
Way, if you leave that either equation out, it becomes self-centered. It becomes prideful, self-centered. You just focus on loving God, it becomes a knowledge-based love, and you become prideful in that. Then if you just are always focused on loving others and doing for others, it can become self-absorbed as well. Without that, like she was talking about, the love flowing out of you from the Lord, you're doing it for the glory of the Lord. If you're focused on self, either way, that's what I see happening in my own life. You know, if you don't
this reciprocal thing, then you're always focused on what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. You know, the example you brought up was the monks. At that time, who would have been somebody you could say was maybe out of balance, loving God with everything, following all 613 rules, but wasn't really good at loving people?
Pharisees,
which this will make total sense when we see what he does next, when he just goes to town on the Pharisees. But yeah, I mean, you go too far in that direction, you end up with a very self-centered kind of religion. The other side of that is a little more difficult to define, I think. And that is, what if I love without that love that's empowered by God and with the knowledge of God?
Everybody's love's individual. I mean, you don't know what true love is if it doesn't come from God.
True.
Right, and then you have expectation with that love, which is not true love.
Well, we just read what, you know, true love was a minute ago, right? 1 Corinthians 13. How easy is that? How y'all doing with that? You know, I mean, we love imperfectly. It is really, I kind of like to think of it in this way. Modern examples, and by the way, these are just ones that I came up with off the top of my head, but on the one end, if we go over this way, and we say, we're going to love the Lord, you know, with all we've got, we're going to do what the Bible says, and da-da-da-da, you know, when you go off that cliff, you end up with your Westboro Baptist churches. You know, that's the church that goes around and protests at military funerals and have the horrible signs and things that they put out. And just, I don't think they love people. When you listen to interviews, it's just so angry and so raging. And you know, I fear condemning some things. I will condemn that, but at the same time, it's like I'm not perfect either, so I got to be careful with that. God will deal with them. If they are God's children, God will deal with them, and I don't want to be in that place, right? But then on the other side, so what do you end up with when it's just we love our neighbor as ourselves as best we can, right? And I think that's where you end up with disordered love. I got to go to a cool conference earlier this week for classical schools, and I got to listen to one of the speakers was just phenomenal. He teaches an aesthetics class at a classical school, and we were getting into the good, the true, and the beautiful, and how God relates to those things, and how you teach that in a classroom. It was just so cool. But he was trying to talk to his kids about disordered love, and he said that he always uses this example. Do you love pizza? Yes. Do you love babies? Well, yes, we should love babies. It's like, what if a baby's falling and a pizza's falling and you have to grab one of them? What do you grab? He said most of the teenage boys are like, But eventually they come around. I grab the baby. Right. Because in a properly ordered love, a baby is of infinite value to God and should be of infinite value to you. Whereas a pizza... I like pizza, but it does not have the same value. So what we end up with is what we call disordered love, which is really what sin is. If you think about it, almost all sin is simply disordered love. It's putting things in an economy that God does not agree with, okay? So an example of that would be whatever my kids want, I placate that. You know, you guys should know if you've ever, you know, had children, at some point you have to tell them no because they're little tyrants, right? Or if you think they're making unwise choices, you say no. And so, you know, a good example of that is kind of some of the craziness we see with some of what I see happening with children in the transgender movement. This idea that, well, my kid has these thoughts at the age of 5 that they're not really a boy, they're a girl, so I'm going to just feed that because I love my kid and my kid's right and how could they be wrong, that kind of thing. And it's just like, tap the brakes a little bit, you know. Maybe there's something else going on there. And here's the thing. I am in no way condemning kids that are confused about these issues. God have mercy on anybody who's confused with those issues. You know, I know people who are confused about their sexuality. I know people who've grappled with these things, and parents who've had to grapple with these kinds of issues. And God have mercy. But to just say, whatevs, that's not love. It is not. My child wants to play in the road. I don't say take off, have a good time. You know, I don't. So love is hard sometimes. Sometimes love means redirecting. Sometimes love means I don't get my way. And it's those kinds of things that we end up with when we go too far that direction. A good example of that, and that's why I think oftentimes when you have things like you know, the great political movements of the last 300-400 years, the great Marxism, you know, supposedly Marxism is all about everybody getting their fair share, right? Well, fairness is a quite juvenile concept, so very separate from justice. Justice is getting what you deserve. Fairness is not. And this idea, and so therefore, when Marxism has been tried on a grand scale, and it is not ordered by love, it is not ordered by God, you end up with genocide in your own country because you got to kill a bunch of people to make it work, right? That's disordered. And so you go too far one direction or the other, you fly off the rails. And that's of course, what Jesus was saying there. And I think that's why he said both of those. This is because he is going to turn and he's going to say, some of you guys are following every rule you've got, and you are terrible people because of the way you treat people. Okay? So it's important. It's important to do both. So he says this, and they're like, good answer, good answer. Because, you know, nobody's going to disagree with that necessarily. But then he turns around, and this is what's fascinating. What's different about this passage and every passage we've gotten to up to this point, as far as his interaction with the folks in the temple area? While the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them, "What do you think about the Messiah? Whose son is he?" "The son of David," they replied. He said to them, "How is it then that David, speaking by the Spirit, calls him Lord? For he says, 'The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet.' If then David calls him Lord, how can he be his son?" No one could say a word in reply, and from that day on, no one dared ask him any more questions. What's different about this passage, though? Jesus asked the question this time. Every other conversation had been initiated by them asking Jesus a question. Now, Jesus asked the question because he is about to take them to school, okay? And that was the point. This is a pivot point, okay, in this whole discussion here. Remember how we said thematically what we had seen in Galilee was Jesus giving himself and then being rejected and him walking away from that, okay, by the Jews. Then he goes to Jerusalem, to the leadership, you know, the religious leadership of Jerusalem. He presents himself again. He comes with the triumphal entry, right? He does this teaching, all this teaching in the courtyard there at the temple. What do? Rejection. So he wants to make a point about Messiah. So he asks them, what do you think about Messiah? I love that. You know, and I'm sure they were all kind of like, well, you know, what is he, where is he going? So he gets specific. Whose son is he? And they respond, correctly, son of David. Because they knew it had to be someone of the lineage of David. But by saying son of David, they have grounded their response in the material world. Remember what they thought Messiah was supposed to be? David was a what? He was a king. What was he before he was a king? He was a warrior. David was a champion. David was a fighter, right? So when they talk about son of David, that's what they're thinking. Thinking warrior, king, fighter, somebody who's going to wipe these cursed Romans out, kick them out, and let's start over, okay? To which Jesus wanted them to think this through, okay? That was true in as much as he was of the lineage of David, but the point that he wanted to make was, well, tell you what, let's talk about that concept. And so he quotes from Psalm 110. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet. Now, Psalm 110 is a Psalm of David. It's David writing. You can go back and look. It begins, a Psalm of David. And it's kind of like, I don't know, are y'all like me when you read that? You're kind of like, that's really bad grammar. You know, the Lord said to my Lord, you know, who's talking? Who are they talking to? What's going on? Basically, the point Jesus wanted to make to them was look, how can David's son be his Lord? That's the question he was asking. That's a weird question. It's a weird statement, right? By the way, Psalm 110 is a passage that was used by the church a whole lot. And we see it even later on in the New Testament as a messianic proof. This is one of those passages from the Psalms that they look at and they say, this points to Messiah, this points to Messiah. This one in particular, this idea that the lineage of David, this is David speaking in kind of almost this cryptic way of this idea of the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand. So it's God talking to Jesus saying, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet. If then David calls him Lord, how can he be his son? That's the point. The Messiah that's coming is not just of the lineage of David. This is a different kind of Messiah. This is not a Messiah grounded in the world that you see. This is not a Messiah that the zealots, remember those guys that wanted to overthrow Rome and assassinated people and stuff like that? This is not the kind of Messiah those guys are going to follow. Just not. It's going to be different. And then, after doing this, he rounds on them and goes to town. Now, I'm just going to read this passage. We're going to stop. We're going to pick up here next week. But basically, he says, then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, the scribes and the Pharisees, sit on Moses' seat. So do and observe whatever they tell you. Listen, he says, do what they tell you, but not the works they do, for they preach, but they do not practice. They tie up heavy burdens hard to bear and lay them on people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to move them with their finger. They do all their deeds to be seen by others, for they make their phylacteries broad and their fringes long, and they love the place of honor at feasts and the best seats in the synagogue and greetings in the marketplace and being called rabbi by others. But you are not to be called rabbi. You have one teacher, and you're all brothers. And to find out what phylacteries and things like that are, you'll have to come back next week. So that's where we'll pick up, okay? Tell you what, let me pray for y'all. I know it's going to be kind of crazy over there with VBS going on, so I'm going to let you guys out a little early today. God have mercy on us. God have mercy on me. I am so not good at loving people. I'm not even good at loving my own family some days. Father, have mercy on us and forgive us. But Father, remind us that it is in loving you that our other loves become ordered appropriately. That God, by loving you, by following you, by connecting to you, we can love others. That you give us the grace to love those who are hard to love. That you give us the grace to be patient and forgiving. God, I pray that you would remind us of that this week. It is only by time and your grace that we can even love one another well. And so, God, I ask for all of us here, the time to spend with you, that we might love each other well and appropriately. And I pray all of these things in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Y'all have a fantastic week and hope to see y'all Friday. Thank you.